Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach on this August 22nd, 2015, starring Jeff and
Jake McClure.
And the reason I keep saying August 22nd is we're probably going to play this again.
On the 29th.
On the 29th. And so if it's the 29th, you can call.
But we won't answer.
But we won't answer because there will be a time warp. You will actually be in a different physical location than we are right now. You will be literally hundreds of thousands of miles away. And if we play it again later, which we may do, it very well may be that you will be millions of miles away from where we are right now and through space.
See, we can make a prediction here. We can make a prediction that if this is a rerun, then you're listening to us in the future.
Right.
There you go. That's my prediction.
And
if you're not listening to us in the future, then you can't hear me make the prediction, and therefore it didn't happen.
In the numbers for the speed at which your planet on which you reside, first off, it's traveling around the sun at about 150,000 miles an hour.
Spaceship Earth.
And the sun itself is traveling around the center of the galaxy at a pretty fair clip. I don't remember the exact number, but even more impressive is the fact that the galaxy itself is moving really, really, really fast towards Sagittarius, which is moving away from us.
But we're moving towards it.
Mm-hmm. Our galaxy is galloping towards... We have a galloping galaxy.
Galloping galaxies.
We're galloping towards...
This sounds like a phrase from the Batman comic book.
And I know you're going to think this is going to be a bit absurd, but we're actually moving several million miles an hour right now. And it's all relative. But
some of my relatives are easier to deal with than others.
The end result is, that's why every time I see a time travel movie or something, I think it's really funny. Get in the machine here,
and you appear back in time... But you didn't really travel a great distance to do it. You'd be floating in space.
Right. You wouldn't. That's why time travel has never worked real well, because probably a lot of people have invented it. They've jumped in their time machine.
And disappeared.
They've gone back in time, and when they stepped out, they were hanging in the middle of interstellar vacuum. And
doesn't work very well.
A few minutes later, they were dead.
It's kind of tough.
So, time travel doesn't work.
Well, it does work. Absolutely.
Forward.
I am in a time machine at this moment. It goes forward 1 second at a time.
Right. Exactly.
Exactly 1 second at a time.
Precisely. 1 second per second.
Right.
Forward in time. Now, you can actually let everybody accelerate away from you if you want to go fast enough, but that gets sort of awkward, to say the least. Okay, so you are listening to The Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number's in here, 773-1400 or...
1-866-597-1400.
We've made several predictions over the years.
Yes.
Among them, that the euro... We've been saying for many years that the euro is toast.
Yes. It's down to $1.13 a euro at this point.
And it's only a matter of time, barring... Now, the Russians could actually cause the Europeans to develop a constitution. Our constitution in the United States, we used to have a system very much like the European Union.
A federation or a confederacy.
And we used something called a thaler. It was called the continental thaler.
The dollar. Yes.
But we called it dollar, but it was actually thaler originally.
Right. Yeah, originally.
And we had these continental dollars that weren't worth anything, and if you're my age, you remember very commonly your parents using the term not worth continental. We've forgotten that now.
I thought they were talking about breakfast.
Yeah, I thought they were talking about cars. Lincoln Continental.
Right.
But the point is that the continental dollar was what they were referring to, which became worthless, as the euro will eventually.
It wasn't worthless. You could use the paper for wallpaper.
It and the Dixie were about the same value for the same reason.
Yeah.
And so... The point is that the reason we formed a constitution is not because our founding fathers were all noble and cool and had great ideals. They may have had all of that stuff, but that wasn't the cause. The cause was Great Britain did not recognize that its colonies had actually become an independent nation and said in very, very clear terms. As soon as we get done with the French, we're going to come back and kick your butts.
This Napoleon guy needs to be taken care of. We'll be right back. Hold on.
So there was this war, by the way, in 1812, that where they tried to do that. But by then, we had a constitution.
They burned down the White House.
They did. Urban renewal. And we got a new one.
Oh, yeah.
We got a new one.
It's much nicer now.
Right. And the point is that it takes an external threat for a confederation like the European Union.
Or the colonies, which became a country.
Right. Or the 13 American colonies to actually become a republic and have a constitution. They have to have an external threat that's bad enough that they can learn to get along with each other and allow somebody to take charge of all of them.
Now,
because
it doesn't mean that they stay getting along.
We will either hang together, or we shall surely all hang separately.
Yes, the whole concept,
as Benjamin Franklin said.
Right, that it doesn't mean that we're going to get along forever, as you referenced by the 1860s. We had a minor disagreement that due to some.
We had a reorganization.
I think the polarization in the political viewpoints it measured in the polls. Was measured in body counts.
Right. And it was a corporate reorganization.
Right.
It was a takeover. Anyway,
we're the only ones that think we're funny here.
It was a hostile takeover. So the Russians really could serve a very good purpose if they were to sufficiently threaten Western Europe.
But that would require oil prices to be high for longer.
Well, there's an alternative
or
to this.
Total collapse of oil prices, and they have no alternative except invasion.
That's right. They are, and it's one of those real possibilities that's out there that could save the Europeans' hide, is that Russia will get so desperate because of the drop in the price of oil.
Right.
That they realize it's now or never. And so they start grabbing neighborhood countries. They're actually in a position.
They've increased their budget for defense this year. And this is in
their military budget.
Their military. Well,
I don't know if you'd call it defense.
We call it defense, but they call it, I will defend myself through taking your country away.
Right, which is the way the Russians do that. That's because they don't have natural boundaries. There's
right.
Nothing, there's nothing to stand behind if they tried to defend.
Peace on earth. Peace of this and peace of that.
Yeah. The issue is that if you've ever read the book Red Storm Rising, which is a
Tom Clancy
worthy book to read, because Tom Clancy was quite a prophet. You realize that the reason in his theoretical exposure of the Soviet Union attacking the West,
right,
the reason behind it was basically they had a huge refinery fire and they realized that their economy was going to collapse as a result of this fire. Because they were teetering on the edge,
right.
And they had been building up their military, and they have a choice then. They can either shut down their military and become defenseless.
Or use the military.
Or use it while they have it because they realize they're going to run out of money in the near future. And Tom Clancy's theory was that they would use it while they had it. And in fact, those of us in the military at the time and in military intelligence saw that very idea beginning to take shape. And then Gorbachev decided that the Soviet Union probably could not win a long-term war with the United States. He had a sudden attack of rationality.
The sudden attack of rationality had a lot to do with the fact that we had the first Gulf War and we trounced the Iraqi army with very little problem, even though they had Russian advisors.
And it's a distinct possibility. Now, probability, I wouldn't think so, but distinct possibility that the guy who's in charge of Russia right now might arrive at the conclusion that since the Europeans basically don't have a defense force.
Besides the Americans.
And the Americans have decided, and we have decided in the United States, to cut our armed forces and our budget back to the lowest level, back to pre-Cold War levels.
Right.
That it might be time to attack Europe. Now, if he does, if he gets warmed up, because the economy in Russia is so structured right now that they've got about 4 or 5 years of military buildup, which they're working on and spending a tremendous amount of money on, before they run out of money.
So using sometime, sovereign funds.
Sometime in, well, not just sovereign funds, their total tax revenues versus mm-hmm. what they mm-hmm. have on hand. You look at the entire picture.
This year what they're doing is they are dipping into their mm-hmm. sovereign fund to extend their military.
So they can't do that very long. 4 or 5 years on the outside, and at that point, they either have to shut the whole thing down and let it rust and turn all the people back into the economy.
Or lack of economy, as we would.
Or they have to start taking, in other words, if you build a big factory to make widgets, you either have to make widgets or you have to shut the factory down. And the point is that it's the same thing that's happening in the oil fields. Despite the fact that pumping oil out of the ground is causing the price to fall, which causes the profitability to fall.
They have to pump because if they don't pump, they can't pay their debts.
And they've got this huge investment. And they've sunk everything into it. And by the way, it's called the sunk capital fallacy.
Right. The sunk capital fallacy is what happens when you have a big company that over the years has developed a massive infrastructure to make things, and a new technology comes along that isn't massive, that smaller things can use. In this case, it's fracking. That comes along and starts at the lower end and starts taking up the market share on the lower end. And the Toyota did this in the car industry until they became the biggest car manufacturer.
The point is, in the sunk capital fallacy, it's I've got so much money in this thing, I need to carry forward with it because I've got so much money in this thing.
Right.
And that's what's going on in the oil fields right now. They've got, obviously the people who are doing all this could just throw their hands up and saying, okay, I'm declaring bankruptcy. You banks, you're welcome to take
whatever you want. They throw good money after bad.
Then you can lose money on it too. But people don't like to do that. They don't like to lose. And the Russians don't like to do that. They don't like to lose. And the Russians are paranoid. So there's a distinct possibility that the
a stinky possibility.
European Union's Eurozone will be rescued by the Russians because they will develop a constitution. But if the Russians don't come to their aid by attacking them, does that sound weird?
Well, boy, does it sound weird.
Or at least threatening credibly to attack them, then the European Union is going to fall apart. And the Eurozone will fall apart. The free trade zone will stay there.
The trade zone and the agreements to prevent war mm-hmm. will probably exist, but that
even that,
the fact that the euro has no authority to back it.
But once it starts falling apart, if Greece leaves, which it's still a distinct possibility, if the European Union starts, the eurozone starts deteriorating. Nobody knows how far that will go. Europe has this history of forming alliances and cartels and
just look at the League of Nations.
And then when they fall apart, they generally do so with what happens is the pie gets small enough that either the Germans or the French or somebody decide they're going to take the rest of the pie before somebody else does.
Right. In this case, the pie is a Wiener Schnitzel.
Could be. I'm going to have to work on that. All right. Pi r square. Anyway, the point is that we've been saying for a long time the European Union, the Eurozone, isn't going to work. We've also
long before the
crisis, unless they have a constitution and they blew the constitution off, and I don't think they're going to get it back. The other thing we've been saying for a long time is that China won't work.
Yeah, demographically, it's impossible for China to continue as a viable mm-hmm. country into the future.
And China has got, and this is one of those things that a lot of people in the United States, I think, do not understand. China's debt is much larger as a percentage of its economy than the American debt, much larger.
Right.
It's just hidden in state-owned companies that, for example, built a whole series of cities across China that nobody lives in. They're called ghost cities. They're just concrete structures all over the place. Nobody lives there. They did that to keep people employed.
And to keep the economy growing shouldn't have been growing.
And the companies that built those with money they borrowed.
From state-run banks.
Right. State-run companies.
Borrowing from state-run banks.
But the debt is still on the books. And if that debt is ever realized, if the banks have to fess up and say, yep, we have to write that off.
Because the government requires the banks to keep them on the books.
Right. And eventually, that stuff has a tendency to come home to roost. And when it does, all those huge reserves that the Chinese government has will be required to cover that.
Well, and there's the major piece that fits right into the middle of this is that
right.
demographically, a child in China today is the only grandchild of four grandparents.
Right.
That at some point in the future, that grandchild is going to have to, when they get into the workforce,
mm-hmm. support.
Support six people, their parents and their parents' parents, because they're the only one to do it. And that's not possible. Mm-hmm. It cannot be done. Right? There is no social welfare program for retirees in China that would apply. The vast majority of social welfare is within the family. And when the family is that upside down, it doesn't work.
And this is one of those things that the Chinese scholars have said over and over again. If the growth rate in China drops below 6.5% a year, their unemployment rate will suddenly shoot off the charts, because there's just so many people involved.
Right.
And you will have literally a group of people, roughly, last estimate I heard, 300 million people who are angry and hungry.
That's the population of the United States.
But it won't be the population of the United States that's angry and hungry, though.
No, but that's the size of the population of the United States. Sorry.
And that's how revolutions occur. Now, and factor in one other element about China, which is why we've been saying that China is fundamentally unstable. Now, they're running this mass experiment, and who knows? It might succeed.
Yeah, I mean, they've pulled it off longer than we expected them to.
China is actually five nations with five different languages, with five different cultures.
They actually have more than that, but these are the major ones
that are held together by the military force of the central government in China. And the military force of the central government in China is held together because of the fact that they pay them.
If you stop paying them,
then
bad things happen.
So could a lot of bad things happen down the road? Yes.
Yes.
Notice, though, and this is so important if you're an investor, none of those bad things are at all likely to happen in the United States of America. We have this plotting growth economy that we're complaining isn't growing fast enough, but it is growing, unlike the Chinese economy. It is gradually picking up speed in its growth, unlike the Chinese economy or the European economy.
Pulling ahead.
And it works. And you happen to live in that nation, and hopefully you happen to invest in that nation. And we do buy things from other places, and we do use other nations to do things that we don't want to do. This is not the first time in the history of the world that this has happened. And basically, it's a good time to be an American, and it's a good time to invest.
Part of the reason why the slowdown is happening in China is because industry is taking off in the United States. Now, the jobs, the workforce that is involved in manufacturing in the United States, when you consider heavy industry, is lower than it was in the 70s because we're using a lot more robots. Because robots are cheaper than even Chinese workers. We're bringing a lot of that industry back to the United States because we don't need cheap labor if we have cheap robots. And the robots are getting cheaper every day, which is more instability in China. We said it was the factory of the world. Well, it's becoming less so. If it continues to slow down its growth rate, it's not going to catch up with the United States economy, because the economy of the United States, when it's growing at the rate that it is slightly faster growth overall. Even
yeah.
though it's a 2% growth rate, we have a bigger economy, so 2% of a bigger economy is better than the 6 to 6.5% growth rate in China.
Every objective measure says that the United States economy, in absolute terms, grew more in the last 12 months than did the Chinese economy. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, long-time listener. I tuned in late, so you may have already talked about this. The Wall Street Journal said that there's corrections in the stock market about every 18 months, and this
on
has
average.
Gone on for 4 years.
Right.
So is that because of the artificially low inflation, or interest rates, or is it QE, or what is that? I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
There's an easy answer to that. Generally speaking, we don't have the kind of slow growth rate that we've had. If we have a faster growth rate, you should expect to have corrections more often. If we have a slow growth rate, it drags out the time when instabilities grow in the market with it. I mean, anytime, the reason why corrections are good, and people talk, we've said that last hour, it's important to know. The reason why corrections are good is because if the market just goes up and doesn't go down, then we're paying for things that have no value in there too. There are companies that get started that aren't profitable. But if everybody just buys them because the economy is good and they're not profitable, then we have a problem. It's only when the market drops enough for us to get scared a little bit that we look around and we say, hey, we don't need these non-profitable companies in the middle of the mix. Let's pull our money out of that and make sure that we're more conservative in our approach. Mm-hmm. You can go back to the dot-com bubble. You can where you have all these great ideas with no profit. Great ideas that were not possible to have profit from. And it, without the ability for us to say that's not a viable solution in the future because you're not going to make profit, we need these corrections.
When they say an average of 18 months, remember that that doesn't mean every 18 month that we have a correction. What happens is, if you look at history, and I have, when a financial recession occurs as opposed to a business cyclical recession, they're completely different things. A business cyclical recession says we have too much inventory, people have bought all the stuff they're going to buy, and they pull back, and we got to write off the inventory, and we get a downturn. And this is a natural up and down motion in the market that's necessary in a healthy capital market. But when we have a financial meltdown, when we have a credit-based recession, like the one we had that bottomed out in 2009, then it's a different issue because it takes a long time to burn off and go through refunding all the debt that was created in the private sector during the mania that preceded the financial meltdown. And it's still going on in Europe. We have not finished working through this stuff yet.
Yeah, but when the market,
Puerto Rico is Illinois. Yeah.
Pennsylvania, New Jersey.
You go down and look at the municipals, you look at the companies. Now, are we most of the way through it? Yes. And we are transitioning right now, finally, from mostly in recovery to a balance between recovery and expansion. And during that period in the middle, you start to see some of the normal variance that we see in the market. And this is what we call normal variance. A 10% correction is normal variance. The market is basically getting back to normal. So it is also normal during a recovery from a financial collapse not to have very many and infrequent and relatively mild corrections, because there's nothing to correct. As long as the market remains dramatically undervalued, there's not much correction to correct.
Yeah, if you look at the amount of drop that we had in 2007 and 2008, we had a 50%+ drop in the market. That gets rid of a lot of the dead wood. And then people are a lot more afraid about buying that dead wood because they go, whoa, I just got burned really, really bad, because dead wood burns very easily. That's to mix the metaphors a little bit more. So when people are as afraid as they are, we get slow growth almost by definition because people are afraid to take risks. When people are afraid to take risks, they're less likely to overextend. So you get less of those corrections. And this is an overextension.
And there's one big piece of dead wood that caused the recession in 2011, that caused the correction in 2011, and that is a gerrymandered Congress.
Yes.
Congress itself, but the fact that it's gerrymandered so that extremists basically determine who gets elected to Congress.
And we still have that as a fundamental issue.
If we can move beyond, that's another thing we need to move beyond, and several states, including California, have moved beyond it now, to get rid of the gerrymandering that puts in high-focus
polarity
Democrats and high-focus Republicans in the House of Representatives. If we can get past that, then we can get into some serious expansion. And we have another caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm thinking about buying a trailer and a lot, roughly about $10,000. And I'm wondering the best way to go about that. Do y'all make those loans?
No.
About what would it run a month on $10,000?
Okay. What you're gonna need to talk to a bank about this. How much money do you want to put down on it?
Oh, I was thinking about just paying the whole thing with, like you say, a bank loan or something.
No, well, you got to put money down for the bank to give you money. They want you to be invested, too. Otherwise, they're afraid you're not going to make the payments.
Right. Well, probably a couple thousand.
Okay. Well, that's a reasonable amount. One of the things that's true about trailer loans is that the interest rate on a trailer loan is going to be higher than the interest rate on a non-manufactured home. And the reason is because the trailer decays faster. And the word mortgage is two words. They're French, and I'm sorry, excuse my French here. It's mort and gauge. Gauge is a measurement, and mort means death. It's the life expectancy of the building, the structure. And the life expectancy of a trailer is much shorter. So you're probably going to have at most a 15-year note on that loan, a 15-year loan, and it's going to be at a higher interest rate. So be aware of that. But if you're able to put down a couple of thousand at the beginning, then you're talking about an $8,000 loan.
Do you have a relationship with the bank?
I've got a bank that might, but I've had little trouble. I just don't like the loan from banks.
Well, let me tell you, ultimately, when you borrow money, you're borrowing from a bank somewhere. Your best bet, I'm just going to tell you straight up front, your best bet is to go to the bank where you do business, sit down with a person in the bank, tell them what you want to do, and they'll give you the requirements. And you may not meet the requirements, but over the next several years, you may be able to put yourself in the position where you can meet the requirements.
Now, I have a question, though. Where are you getting a $10,000 trailer?
Well, it's a trailer and lot, you know. It's from a friend that is wanting to sell it, mm-hmm. and they'll give me a special price and everything. What would the interest be on that?
It all depends on what the bank looks at you and looks at the lot and looks at the trailer and thinks would be a good interest rate.
Yeah.
And it's, again, we don't do that. It's not an area that we work in, but that's where the banks are. And you just need to go sit down with a loan officer at the bank where you do business, where you have your checking account. And that's
I've got a card that I could put $10,000 on a bank card.
Well, you're going to pay a pretty stout interest rate on that.
No, that's going to be a higher interest rate.
That's why I was asking.
And the other thing is, how are you going to get that $10,000 out of that card and in your friend's hand?
You can write them a check out of the card if they give you these check things to write. But again, the interest rate on that's going to be a lot higher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The reason for that is because the loans on your credit card, they don't have collateral. So
no, this is no collateral card.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just saying,
interest rates are going to be higher.
You're going to pay through the nose on that one.
Okay.
It may be worth it. If you get a good deal on there, it may be worth it. If you have the cash flow to pay it regularly and get it paid off in a couple of years, then you may wind up with a really nice place to live with very low cost.
And if you think you can fix it up and sell it for a lot more money, then you could do that too.
I plan to live in it, you know.
Well, okay. Well, there's your and believe me that if you contact your card company, they'll tell you what the payments will be.
Right.
Okay.
All right, I will do.
Okay, well, thanks for calling.
Thank you. All right.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. And we have some commercials to play.
Commercials?
Now we got to pay for the light bill in here.
Yeah, I guess we'll do that. Well, you're listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and if today is August 22nd, Saturday, 2015. You're welcome to give us a call on the other side of commercials. Telephone numbers are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we have a caller on 773-1400 who has been waiting for a while. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hello, Jake and Jeff. How y'all doing?
Doing good. How are you?
Good. Hey, I enjoyed your program last week, even though it was recorded. And I learned a new word called index, read up about it. But anyway, because I think a lot of the talking heads and pundits are talking bad about the economy. Why aren't the Democrats thinking about, instead of looking for somebody on the Democratic side that's a little bit better in foreign relations, like that guy, what's his name, that Marine, he's the senator from Virginia, or West Virginia, I'm not sure, Jim Webb?
Yeah.
I think that guy would make I think if anything, we're all weak on is probably our foreign affairs right now, which is no doubt in my mind.
Okay.
But I just wondering what kind of... he's not getting very much being looked at on the Democratic side.
Okay.
I think I'm going to take a listen.
All right.
Thank you.
That's an interesting question. I think I actually have an answer for that one. James Webb, who, by the way, was the Secretary of the Navy under Ronald Reagan, is not a young pup anymore, and he has made a couple of runs at the presidency. Very frankly, he is unwilling to, I guess the word would be prevaricate. He is unwilling to pander to the masses to the degree that he would need to do to be nominated, in a nutshell. Frankly, folks, I hate to break this to you, but I've listened to all the Republican candidates very carefully. There's really only one serious Democratic candidate. Bernie Sanders really is pretty much telling it the way he sees it, and as a result has no chance of getting nominated.
Right.
And the every one of the Republicans who is currently running for office is lying to you, with one exception, and he may be telling the biggest lie of all. And I know you...
Wait a minute. We're talking about politicians. You just said something that is useful
right.
In any election.
But
everybody's lying to you.
Not necessarily. I mean, local elections are something you can get people who are just telling the truth. And every once in a while, in a situation where things have gotten completely out of whack, where one party has run the show for a while, somebody can come in. I don't know of anything, very frankly, that Ronald Reagan said while he was running for president that he didn't mean at the time.
Right.
And that's simply because the Democrats have been running the show long enough that they'd gotten things so out of whack that it didn't take a lot to convince people that there was a better way of doing it.
Time to make some changes,
okay?
Yeah.
In this situation, for example, I'll just give you an example. To run on the Republican side, the first thing you have to say is that we're going to do away with Obamacare. You know, there are about 20 million people now who are insured under Obamacare, including my daughter and grandchild. And to suddenly say, guess what, your daughter and grandchild no longer have health insurance because politically I don't like it.
That's not going to apply.
That wouldn't work real well, and Congress would never pass it. And that's just one thing, but there's so many other things out there.
Order to be elected as a Republican, you have to say you want to repeal Obamacare.
And then if you go over to the Democrat side and you look at the things that that you need to do if you're a Democrat to get nominated, that you say that you're going to support, it's way to the left of where you actually have to run in order to win the election.
And once you win the primary, you come back to the center and...
But you got to tell the people who are going to vote in the primary that you're going to be an extremist, but you can't get elected as an extremist. And frankly, James Webb has stated on several occasions, he's written some very good books, by the way, he's simply stated he's just not up to that. Lying was never his strong suit. I have a lot of respect for Jim Webb. I don't think he's a Republican or a Democrat. I think he's just an American, and I think he's probably a pretty honest guy.
You know what's interesting is the polls are showing that the largest percentage of people in the United States no longer identify wholly with the Republicans or the Democrats. And it used to be that the largest percentages were either Republican or Democrat, and it was very close. Now the largest percentage is somebody that's going, man, the extremists are just a little too extreme.
Mm-hmm.
Either side, it's too much.
And very frankly, that's why James Webb is not running for president.
You've got to get through the primary process. And when we talk about that, when you've got a primary process, that the main people that come out to vote in the primary are the hardcore of that party, not the people that I just talked about. The largest percentage of the group are the people in the center. They're not looking at the primaries so much. And even if they are, they've got to deal with, you know, if you've got 40% of the nation sitting in the center, some of them vote in the Republican primary, some of them vote in the Democrat primary, but the reality is that you've got a 30% of the hardcore on either side that outvote the center until you get to the past the primaries, and then the center gets to have its say. But now it's dealing with people that had to run in the primary by saying, I'm really extreme, and I'm going to do things no one else is going to do,
I'm going to do really, really, I'm going to promise you that I'll do really, by the way.
Things that are impossible to do.
If you want to know all the things that presidential candidates are promising that are impossible to do, just go down the list of everything Donald Trump has suggested
he'll
do.
Right, exactly.
He can't do those things.
Can't do those things without support of the other branches, and the other branches would not give the support. And it's, you know, I've made this comparison many times, and I think it's accurate. It's like the high school student body election where the president is running and he says that he's going to eliminate the line in the lunchroom. Well, how else are you going to get the food? Everybody sit down and then they bring out the food to you? Well, that doesn't work. You, the president of the student body doesn't get to tell the lunch lady how to do the cafeteria.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people are going to disagree and they say Trump has got it right and he's got it all figured out, but the fact is, everything I have heard him claim that he is going to do as president is not only impossible, but would be suicidal for the United States economy. So
he would either change after the primary to get more center, or he's not going to get elected.
Right. And let's move on to another political subject, though.
Oh, dear.
And it's a political subject that is near and dear to my heart and our hearts. There are attack ads being run right now against the Department of Labor's fiduciary standard rule. Let me explain something very basic. A person who is not operating under fiduciary standard, a person who is a salesperson, a financial advisor, as they call themselves, has a primary obligation to work for his or her company and make them a profit. They, by definition, will not disclose the conflicts of interest, the under-the-table payments, and all the other things that's causing them to sell something, because they're selling something where they can make money, where they can make a living. They're operating in their company's best interest and in their best interest. The fiduciary standard that the Department of Labor has proposed, which, by the way, is required by law, which Congress could revoke, but they're not going to, the fiduciary standard that the Department of Labor has proposed and the brokerage firms are screaming to stop simply says that a person who is offering you investment advice, not trying to sell you something, but a person who is offering you investment advice and giving you advice on an IRA or on a 401k or 403b or something like that must put themselves in a fiduciary position operating in your best interest and must give you the right to sue them if you find out they've been cheating. Very simple. Meanwhile, the brokerage industries, Merrill Lynch, for example, are hammering Congress and running attack ads against this thing, saying that there simply won't be anybody out there to give you advice unless they can lie. Well, not necessarily lie.
But just not be very clear.
Just not tell you the truth. And operate in their own best interest. Folks, that's absolutely wrong. In Great Britain, they already effectively passed that law, but it was for all securities. And you, a person can simply has to disclose where all the money, where all your money is going and how they're getting paid.
Wait a minute. We already passed the law here, too.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't have the rule for the law to be enforced.
But the rule was put in place in Great Britain. And basically there's two sets of financial representatives who advise people. One set says, hey, I work for a company,
And I get a commission.
And I get a commission. But they have to tell you how much you're paying. And you get to choose how you pay it. And then there's another group that says, no, we don't work for a company. We're going to work solely for you. And they also have to tell you how much you're paying and how you're going to pay it. And they've discovered something amazing. There are more people getting advice.
Better advice.
And the price of advice dropped once it was disclosed.
Because it's kind of, I mean, if you go somewhere and you hire someone to work for you, and they tell you, well, look in the fine print. It'll tell you the percentage of what I'm doing that I'm getting paid. You probably just made a bad employment decision. If you're hiring someone to give you advice and you don't know the dollar amount that you're paying them, then who's in charge of doing the hiring?
And the issue is that even if you read the prospectus carefully, you won't even find all the stuff that's in there that they're getting paid.
You've got percentages, but then you have to figure out what the breakpoints are, and you got to figure out how much money is being invested at what time and which plan is being used for your commission.
Right, and it's not even the amount of money you're paying them that becomes the issue. The issue is that a salesman is going to have a powerful tendency to sell you the thing that makes the salesman the most money.
Right.
That
seems pretty self-evident.
And so if they can sell you a security that they get paid 7%, so if you invest $100,000...
They get $7,000.
They get $7,000. Or they've got another one that's far less expensive that has a much higher probability of making you money, and they only get 0.25%, which is 0.25% of that. That means they get, what, $250?
Well, $7,000
and they
get $250.
Right.
That's your choice.
So they have a choice. They can either make $7,000 on this transaction, or they can make $250 on this transaction. I don't care how honest the financial advisor is.
There is a strong tendency to choose the $7,000.
Going with the and you get this probably the most popular brokerage firm in the area, where they call themselves financial advisors, is Edward Jones. And Edward Jones just got hit with a huge fine. You're certainly welcome to Google it, in municipal bonds, where they were pretty blatantly violating the law and the rules by marking up municipal bonds that they weren't supposed to mark up and charging people. And so we're talking them refunding tens of millions of dollars to investors across the country, and we're talking about a big fine from the SEC. You're certainly welcome to look up Edward Jones.
$20 million fine.
This is normal behavior in the brokerage world. Whatever we can get away with, because you can't see what you're buying, you don't understand the prices on it. For that matter, the broker who's selling it to you may not have even realized that what they were doing was illegal.
Right.
They simply said, here's what my supervisor said I'm supposed to sell, and it's got a good commission on it, so I'm going to sell it to you.
This is something historically. Government involvement in the free market is important historically, and it sounds weird to say free market and government involvement, but government involvement in the free market goes back to the beginning of the market, in that the government is the one that licenses the scales that weigh the produce weigh the money. The government is the one that licenses the money that's being used in the market. It should also license the fairness of the market. If you're going to be trading in this market, then the price of the product should be listed. That sort of thing is important. When you're talking about a price of a product and you don't know what part of that goes to the person that's selling, then you can't make an informed decision on the right product to purchase.
It's not like you can go and line up three different pickups from three different places and look what you're going to pay for the pickup and look at the interest rates and look at the qualities of the pickup. Securities don't work that way. You're buying something that you hope will happen in the future.
Right.
And you have to trust the people who are selling it to you, who are offering it to you, or who are offering advice. If you're working with somebody who's a fiduciary full-time,
they have to tell you all that stuff.
They
clearly, are, in plain English.
And you can sue them if they have a undisclosed conflict of interest. Whereas if you're working with a financial advisor,
there's a difference there.
You don't have that. I mean, as long as it's a quote suitable, which means it's not unsuitable.
It means it's not bad for you. It may not be the best thing out there. It may not be good for you, but it's not bad for you.
So the bottom, then you can't sue them. And you can maybe take them to arbitration, but the chances are pretty much against you. In fact, you're going to win.
There's really another comparison industry that we can talk about, and that's the supplemental drug industry, or the food supplement industry, where the FDA is involved in prescription medications. They are really involved in making sure that the medication companies are only allowed to say something that they can back up with fact. When it comes to food supplements, which is sold in the same aisle, the food supplement industry is allowed to say a lot of things, and as long as they don't outright lie and say, and even in cases where they do outright lie, there's not enough enforcement available, they're not allowed to tell you that they can cure cancer. Sometimes they tell you that.
But if Congress has specifically forbidden the FDA to even test what's in those capsules.
Right. So when we're talking about that industry, it's very similar to the sales industry versus the fiduciary industry in the financial markets, in that Congress has passed a law that said that for certain types of retirement products, you've got to operate in your client's best interest, except that every time a rule gets proposed, Congress says no.
And that's because they get lobbied hard.
There's a lot of money coming into Congress to say,
if you want to contact your congressman about something, say the DOL fiduciary rule is a good thing. Just that simple. And you can look up fiduciary. I have to sometimes.
Even though we are ones.
Yeah, even though we are fiduciaries, sometimes I have to look up how to spell it because it's a rough word. It just basically means a fiduciary. Now, a person who's a part-time fiduciary, who's also not a fiduciary part of the time, are probably even more scary. By the way, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and this is Saturday, October 22nd of 2015, and we will be playing this again because we're going to be going on vacation. But you can call us off the air. There will be people there even while we're on vacation, or at least a voicemail during the weekend. 947-1111 or
toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, or you can go to the personalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, listen to podcasts, read our philosophy, see our ugly mugs and our beautiful staff.
Your Fox News station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.